This is Sian, and you're listening to Rebel Radio. Fuck you, Josh.
What's up? This is Rebel Radio.
What up? What up? This is DJ Newmark.
This is Peanut Butter Wolf.
It's your boy. It's okay.
Keep checking out Rebel Radio.
Rebel Radio.
This is Rebel Radio.
We in the place right here. Rebel Radio is going down.
Would you say Rebel Radio?
Oh, wait. Let's do it again.
Rebel Radio.
What's up, Rebels? Welcome back to Rebel Radio, the weekly show where I bring you the rebels that are shaping youth culture. We find out how they do it, why they do it, and what you can do to get a little piece of the pie for yourself. We're also the only show to bring you new music every week from our friends over at EDM.com. My name is Josh Levine. My guest this week is Sian. I didn't have him in studio. I went to his, and we did an interview with a beautiful view overlooking the LA skyline. Sian's a DJ, producer. He's the CEO, owner of Octopus Records. He tells us some great stories about how he's sort of trying to redefine the boundaries of the techno genre that he operates in, and how he's trying to transition from a DJ to a touring act, and what that looks like, some of the trade-offs, why it's important to him not to be on the road his entire life. Great stuff coming up with Sian after our EDM.com track of the week. Ecotech with By Your Side, the EDM.com track of the week. If you like that one, get over to EDM.com, check out more new music, and let's get into the interview with Sian. That's funny. Well, let's talk about you, man. I appreciate you doing this and having me in your beautiful home.
Thank you.
I want to talk about how it started for you.
Yeah, it's kind of an interesting one because I suppose I became really focused on a really specific type of music super young.
Yeah.
You know?
So take me back to the beginning. Do you remember the first record you ever bought?
Oh, yeah. When I was a kid, I was obsessed with more like the sound and the atmosphere of things like Peter Gabriel, Duran Duran,
okay.
Like anything that sounded like it was made with a machine, I really zoned in on. And a lot of it was pop music, and then later things like Kraftwerk and Can, and you know.
What's the early record that like you were obsessed with?
I would have to say probably something by Genesis or something like that, you know? Because tonight. Just like drum machine sounds.
Right.
I remember being really, really interested in any music that sounded like Foreigner or Genesis that was kind of synthesizer based.
Okay.
And I mean, it's strange because it instantly sparked this curiosity of trying to figure out how they made those sounds. Because as a kid, I wasn't, you know, synthesizers were really new. And,
sure.
You know, I'm a child of the 80s, so I was like, what the hell is this?
So in the U.S., we had Guitar Center.
Yeah.
Which, like, so I was like 12, and there was one on my way home from school.
Yeah.
So I would just walk in.
Yeah.
And sometimes I would spend 3 hours in there.
Yeah.
You could just play the synths.
Yeah.
I didn't know how to play anything, but
you just making noise.
Mess around.
And that's exactly.
Do they have that in Europe?
Well, at that point, I'd come back from the south of Spain.
Got it.
And like when I was a kid, I lived in this really strange area in the south of Spain where down the street from me was a row of nightclubs in the 80s, which were super like dodgy.
Yeah.
Lots of the strangest people.
Yeah.
And they were listening to like really early Italo disco and early acid house stuff in there. So my parents had a bar and I'd sneak out and stick my head in and listen to it. That's and I was like mind blown by how this was like repetitive and simple. And I started to think like I could kind of do that. So when I got back to Ireland, I'd go into there was like this little thrift store place and I got to know the guy. So I was like starting to buy a lot of records. Like I'd buy them by the weight.
Mm-hmm.
Like they'd charge me whatever, a few euros per kilo.
Crazy.
Yeah, and I was finding all this really cool old experimental electronic stuff and soundtrack music. So then the little secondhand like music shop, I went in, like sold a bunch of records and then bought a synthesizer and went home and like reprogrammed the whole thing.
Wow.
Yeah, like a DX7.
Yeah.
I remember just sitting for like literally a week on end just making sounds on it, and of course not being a true like playing musician. Like I play guitar and keyboards and, you know, whatever makes a noise, but I wasn't skilled enough. So the thing about synthesizers was that you just hit one note and an arpeggiator and make something happen.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah.
That's and that became like, yeah, then I was...
So were you actively trying to make music at that point?
Straight away.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Actually, it was odd because I messed around with sounds for a little while, and then after a few weeks I started trying to figure out how to put them in sequence and trying to make something.
Mm-hmm.
And around the same time I started basically annoying a bunch of engineers in Dublin and just saying like, I'll roll joints, I'll make tea, just let me sit in the studio. And I finally got a job doing that. It was just like, wasn't even paid. It was just like an intern thing where I just watch over their shoulder and make loads of tea, just nonstop cups of tea and roll joints for them and stuff. So then I would stay in the studio at night and do overnight sessions with my friend and just like sleep on the sofa. And that turned into me actually making a record, mixing it down in the studio where I wasn't meant to be late at night.
Mm-hmm.
And I got signed to this label in Paris while I was trying to study and do music technology.
Wow.
And yeah, it's really odd because I was on a path to be a marine biologist.
Oh, wow.
Which is even weirder. Yeah, because I like literally those two things were running parallel. Like I was helping out in the studio and trying to spend nights there, but I'd just been accepted into studying biology and had like a free run through 3 years.
Yeah.
And like ditched it.
What was that decision like?
It was actually really liberating because I realized that...
Because marine biology, sorry to cut you off, but like that seems to be, I mean, I don't know how you got to that point, but that seems to be a career that you choose.
Yeah.
It's not like you know...
Yeah,
it's not
something you think about.
It's not like law or like... You just kind of are like on the path and you kind of keep going.
Yeah.
Like that one you have to...
Yeah. Yeah, it was really specific because as a kid, like as a small child, I was always in the sea and I started to, my parents aren't interested in anything like that. They just like had a bar, whatever.
Yeah.
And I was always in the sea with my brothers. So I started to become like really interested and I was reading all the time about biology.
Yeah.
And then I was really crap at school, but in the last year I put my head down really, really like crammed.
Mm.
So I got a free ride through biology, but like the first month that I got that, I was like, I'm doing this music stuff already.
Wow.
Yeah. It's really weird.
That's crazy.
Mm.
Nice. So, and at what point did you realize that that was going to be, that you were going to be able to do that as a career?
I honestly never thought about that being like a big career. I just kept doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And one record or one project led to another, made a little bit of money that enabled me to kind of scrape by to the next one. And then all of a sudden I put out this one release on Pokerflat in Germany, which was like an important label at that time. We'll be right back. from there I started to get booked, and I was thinking, oh wow, like I'm gonna do some shows around Europe.
Yeah.
But then from there I started to get booked like in other spots too. Mm-hmm. Like Asia, South Africa, then over in the States quite a bit, which led me to just move here and try to focus on here because I wanted to live here anyway. Like my goal was to live in California.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah.
Well, we have great marine biology here.
Exactly. Yeah. I'm in the water all the time here. Yeah.
Nice.
I would like to, I mean, eventually I would like to try and pick it up as a hobby because I'm always snorkeling and uh-huh. messing around. But the only time I get to do that stuff now is in between shows when I'm on tour. You know.
Sure. What's the geography of techno? Like where is it? Is it fully global?
I think.
Or are there spots around the world that?
I think, in Europe, it's from the outside it looks big. You know, it's one of those weird things like Icelandic death metal. I'd compare it to. You know,
okay.
It's like you look at a DJ that's at the top of their game in European techno. And comparatively, if you bring it over and compare it to electronic music in the States, they're like here on a festival lineup and like USA is like up here.
You're talking about like EDM.
Yeah, so yeah. I think
sure.
the really interesting thing about EDM is how it's morphed into absorbing a lot of the underground. Like for example, I never imagined I'd play things like EDCs and mm-hmm. stuff like that, but now they're booking techno acts.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a type of techno that's more translatable to the US.
Yeah.
Because you just have bigger numbers and a slightly younger audience.
Right.
Whereas in Europe, it's like a bunch of 40-year-olds in Berghain,
right.
like analyzing each other's record collection.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I feel definitely. That's one of the reasons I moved out of Berlin, because I'm not that underground like train spotter guy. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
That's so funny. And where else? What's the vibe in Asia and
good. I mean Asia used to Tokyo had a really booming techno scene, which right. I mean I play there once a year and it's still really good, but it's definitely a lot smaller because bass music and EDM has mm-hmm. taken over in such a huge way.
Really?
The major clubs I've switched to that
yeah.
and that's kind of my feeling for like Australia, Africa, but in the States there's something really interesting happening where these big EDM artists are starting to play records from our labels
mm.
and trying, because you know a label like mine is kind of one foot in each camp and it's kind of helping take us to a bigger audience.
So what happens you know, obviously this music is so different to mainstream music in the sense that, you know, it's not artist driven, it's not lyrics driven,
yeah.
right? You don't have hooks, you don't have,
yeah.
you know, young girls singing.
Yeah.
Right? So how does that affect the way the music spreads? So you talk about, you know, a big EDM DJ puts a tune into a set.
Yeah.
Are people Shazamming it, or like how does that then like
yeah.
what does that mean to business
yeah.
when somebody big plays around?
Yeah, I mean you definitely see it. A few big guys last year charted a few of our tracks.
So what,
we saw like
mean,
a spike.
Well, like what's a track?
Well, for example, Moby, Above and Beyond.
Uh-huh.
Strangely, Steve Angelo, Eric okay. Prydz. Those kind of guys would drop a few of our tunes
yeah.
and put it in their charts and, you know, kind of get behind it a bit. And then
okay.
all of a sudden we'd see this spike of new fans. And
yeah.
we'd look at them and say, well, that's super interesting to me. Like most Berlin techno people would be like, oh, EDM.
Right.
But I think it's acting like a huge net. And I mean, everyone's music taste matures as they
sure.
grow up. But if those kids are entering electronic music through this big net of EDM, and then in 2 to 5 years they make the transition from, like, you know, Steve Angelo to Eric Prydz to Deadmau5 and Richie Houghton and Adam Baer, and then, you know, it's kind of already a little system of introducing people to better music.
Interesting.
I shouldn't say better, I should say different music. Yeah,
sure. Yeah, that's really interesting.
Yeah.
Okay, wait, so go back. So you were talking about Genesis to Rick Command, like,
yeah,
you know, synthesizer driven pop music.
Yeah.
And then where did you make the transition to techno? Or
I think the rave scene simultaneously lured me in at the same time that I was listening to things like anything made with synths, like Nitzer Ebb, mm-hmm. Nine Inch Nails, From 242, mm-hmm. Skinny Puppy, like stuff like that was becoming really attractive to me because it's like darker and it
right.
has like a lot more energy, the same kind of energy as harder techno, I suppose.
Yeah.
And then I, you know, going out to raves all the time, at that point, you know, people were playing a Nine Inch Nails record alongside like Sabres of Paradise or a techno track, you mm-hmm. know? So it was kind of this weird mishmash of music that really influenced what I do now.
Yeah.
It's strange how I was so open in the 90s, you know? I mean, I'm kind of the guy who's always trying to find new sounds and mm-hmm. find like new things in music, but I have to say the 90s was a really, really eclectic time for me.
Interesting.
Yeah. Speaking about subgenres, like it's
sure.
seems to be more boxed off, certainly in Europe. Like you can't play a drum and bass record at a techno show or, you know, it's like boxed off.
Yeah. Yeah, I think there's a little bit more of that here, it seems like.
Yeah. Yeah. That's why I prefer playing in the States.
Yeah.
So much more open, you know, yeah. like people are just there to like see the artist and they kind of follow what the artist does. In Europe, people are there for like the scene in a way.
Yeah. Yeah. Which I think used to be, it used to be more like that here.
Yeah.
I don't know. Although, you know, we have such a diverse culture compared to Europe.
Yeah, like you go to a party in Ibiza, it's a bunch of homogenized people right. listening to a specific type of music.
Yeah,
you know, it's not pulling influences from lots of different genres. I mean, I really like to work with people in hip hop or trap or people, you know, I'm a huge metal fan and mm-hmm. I'm not afraid to have those things influence what I'm trying to do.
And your fans or people that follow the label, like, are they open to that?
Not yet, yeah. but in the next year, one of our big plans is to broaden the scope of what we're doing with
nice.
With the label and myself. Like, this, I have an album coming soon that's got some of my guitars on it. It's right. got some, like, yeah, it's got some slower tracks and some ambient stuff. And yeah, it's just kind of all my influences
interesting.
Wrapped up. Yeah.
So how do you balance that? I talk a lot about that on this show and just with friends about the disparity between what the artist wants to make and what the fans want to hear, right?
Yeah.
And I feel like, I think it's for obvious reasons. The artist is always, you know, several steps ahead.
Hmm.
If nothing else, because the music that people are dancing to, you know, today, you made a while back.
Yeah. Yeah.
Although I know that window's gotten shorter, but it's still, there's still a lag.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And if you go out and tour it and whatever, you're sometimes a year later, right?
Yeah. Yeah. It's a long time.
And if you have a hit record, you could be several years performing that same song.
Right? Yeah.
So so there's always that lag and you know, it's understandable, but it's also a problem for artists.
Definitely, yeah.
Because you want to move on.
Yeah.
They want.
Right? They want the same thing.
Yeah.
I think, for me anyway, the only way is not to give a shit and to think, okay, it's like what Henry Ford said, if he gave people what they want, they'd have a faster horse.
Right.
You know, and like sometimes I think it's kind of the artist's job to say like, come with me on this trip, and mm-hmm. whether you fail or win at that mm-hmm. is really dependent on the marketing or something. I don't know, but I mean, I've seen artists go in all kinds of directions successfully. And
who do you think, when you think of that, who does that really well?
For me, Daft Punk as a really commercial example, two guys that were in indie bands, yeah. That's, you know, they got their name from a terrible review of their indie band. It failed. They started another band which failed, and then they were just playing techno, like hard acid techno, in Paris. Once Homework hit and really became a big crossover thing, which is like a really underground album if you listen to it.
Sure.
Then they became this kind of artist that was still uncompromising, but managed to bring all their influences in disco and film music and, you know, and rock too, and kind of put their stamp on it and made it sound like their own. Same with Justice, I suppose.
Maybe
dance music is kind of meant to do that, you know, it's meant to pull all those things in and kind of take those chances.
Every beat, a shadow. Every harmony, an outline. A silhouette of you, is like a pulsating halo. So you have your label and you know, you're a DJ and producer, which obviously is a very common way to operate, especially in dance music. Why is that a good idea?
I think it's kind of a system that's set up whereby your label becomes like this advertisement for who you are and what you know, what you're trying to bring to people in terms of your own sound and uniqueness. Then the DJing thing is still really bizarre to me, you know, like I love DJing, I like playing records, I mostly play sets of my own music or music from the label these days, but I'm actually transforming what I'm doing into being a live act, like a live electronic show. Over the last year I've been working on that. So I mean, the DJing thing is just so interesting for the two types of artists. There's like people like me who would rather be in the studio and not at an after party, and then there's like the DJ guy who's like going out on the road, going nuts every night and going to every after party available, and that was never really what I was about. I would rather be in the studio making music. So those two things are very, very mutually exclusive, you know, because most of the DJ guys have ghost producers, and they're just about the brand, and they go and get those big DJ fees and and then spend that on driving a team, whereas producer people are making their own music and usually have their own label and are kind of trying to build a sound around that.
So what is there is there a downside to kind of having both businesses?
I feel like they're tied to each other, because the bigger your label gets, the bigger your shows get, and also the bigger your shows get, the bigger your label can get. It's an obvious one, but I feel like the lifestyle of going out on the road and going for like 3 days of shows, late nights, airport mess ups, the whole lot, then coming back and being a proper label owner is impossible. Like, I have three people who work with me now, and I've started to do less but bigger shows, so just focusing on ones that are really significant and I know that are going to be the right moves. But before, there was a period where I was running the label on my own and doing like 3 shows or 4 shows a week sometimes. So that was like in a hotel room, working on the plane. You know, and when you think about it, like, as I'm sure you know, running a label is loads of back-end office work. It's not like glamorous at all.
It's not like feet up on the desk, smoking a cigar, like signing.
No, it's like, you know, Excel forms, you know. And I think that's why a lot of people just use their DJ fees to pay someone to do that.
Yeah. learned about your own creativity and, like, you know, when are you, what circumstances allow you to be most creative?
When I know that I don't have to go to the airport in 10 minutes, basically.
Yeah.
I think any artist ultimately has this weird thing where, luckily, you know, I'm being careful of this, but friends of mine, they put out a record, it does well, and then they go on tour for like eternity because they'll take every single show, even if it's not paid well or attended well. They'll just take all those shows just to be out on the road, living the life, and then their creativity just goes.
Sure.
I've seen it with so many bands, so many artists, and like when you come home from a Monday of 3 or 4 nights of partying and, you know, a 12-hour flight delay, you don't want to make music or.
Of course.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I've tried to avoid that, and I think the key is to. I mean, for me anyway, I want to become like a live electronic act and go on tour for a period and then go off tour for a period. But the DJ lifestyle is just nonstop touring. I mean, bands never do that. Hip hop artists never do that.
Right.
Like DJs do 2 or 3 gigs a week, every single week.
Yeah.
And it's not, I mean, unless you're talking like EDM level, higher level, in techno, it's not as, I mean, it's overinflated. It's not a good business.
Yeah. What do you mean?
Like, for example, I have some friends who will go out on tour and they will hammer it. Like, they're working really hard on the road. They're doing every show they can. They come back, and after they've paid their management and their agent, plus the flights, plus booking fees, plus hotels, plus living on the road, they're like hood rich, you know? It's not, I mean, unless you get your fees up to the level of an established act, like an underground techno DJ is like a terrible career option.
No, I get it.
Yeah, especially in Europe where the fees are like a fifth of what they are here.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
I didn't realize that.
It's strange because there's a lot of bigger clubs in Europe that will actually pay artists less because of the, you know, the willingness of underground artists to try and play that venue.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting economy, right? And
yeah.
There's always that, you know, there's always the question, I think, of who's, you know, what's the draw? Is the DJ the draw? Is the club the draw? Is the promoter the draw?
Yeah.
You know, you don't have that. You don't have that in the movie business.
Yeah.
Right, where people...
Right.
You know, they come to see a film.
Yeah.
Not because the theater is there. I mean, I guess, you know, in some ways they do.
Yeah.
But for the most part, right, it's very clear that the value is on the film side.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. And I think that's true for the actual music business. I would say in the underground business, it's like not really a business. It's just a bunch of dudes who hang out at an after party trying to put a tour together, and that it's kind of I'm kind of grateful.
But even so, I think, like, you know, look at the festival business, right? Like the better festivals, you know, granted, you know, Coachella plays, they pay big fees, but they don't have to. Right, like, first of all, they sell out most of the tickets before they announce the lineup. People just trust that they're gonna have a lineup.
That's true.
And secondly, you know, does any one act affect the ticket sales that much? Probably not.
Yeah, that's true.
So, you know, I think in some cases the festival has become the brand.
Yeah, or a festival like Burning Man where the fans create the festival.
For sure.
You know?
Yeah. Or, you know, I think if you look at, like, Lightning in a Bottle, you know, I think most people... Yeah, they get excited about who's playing.
Yeah.
They're really going
For the experience. I've noticed that with electronic festivals recently.
Yeah.
It seems like you're going to the circus, you know? Yeah. It's like these crazy, like going to a fairground, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, well, I mean, EDC is like, they're the best at that, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's, I don't know.
It's kind of a spectacle.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, I guess that's just festival culture in general. People don't really know who they were dancing to until they go and check it out later. Right. Like, that was great, I think. You know?
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah.
It's interesting. I eventually want to move into being more of like an act rather than a DJ.
Yeah.
You know, so that you can go to a city and do a show. It's like a hard ticket, like proper show, you know. Mm-hmm. It's interesting because most DJs don't think like that.
So why is that a good idea?
Because I'd like to try and build a different type of following where you have a fan base that's like a little bit less about the scene and more about like your development as an artist. And you know, when you, for example, someone like Flying Lotus or Mode Selector or Trentemøller, I mean, will go to a city and do hard ticket shows, and people are kind of there for their vibe, you know, and not, it's a club that's booking all these techno acts every weekend, and you know,
interesting.
Mm.
So we were talking earlier that you've got a collaboration with Will Clark coming.
Yeah, yeah. It's called Amok.
Amok.
Yeah.
Yeah. So how does stuff like that? How do you collaborate? What kind of collaborator?
It's it's weird actually how that came about. We literally went for a bowl of ramen and we're just like talking about music and influences and stuff.
Yeah.
And we decided on doing something like really quickly. So for me anyway, it's better, like I work on a very small electronic setup. I'm not in this big studio with all this gear. And it's really easy for me to just send parts to someone or them send parts to me. Yeah. I work on it, throw it backwards and forwards. Like I don't need to be in the studio with someone and doing multiple takes and whatever. It's really nice way to work actually because it's so fast.
That's funny, I just had Kenny Larkin, I just interviewed him last week. And he was talking about, I guess he's got this big studio. And he can't stop himself from buying new gear.
Yeah.
And he, you know, we joked about it, but like he's convinced himself that that helps him be creative, right? That he gets a new piece and he can't wait to go use it and make something and and whatever.
Yeah.
And, you know, we were sort of joking that like, well, you know, that you don't actually need any of the gear, but if it makes you productive, then it's a worthwhile investment.
Totally, right? I'm the same, but with plugins.
Yeah.
Like, luckily, I used to work in a studio full of analog gear. I used a big 48 channel desk, the whole lot, because you used to have to do that. But everything that I liked about that, I can do much faster on my laptop now, and without the compromise on sound quality.
Yeah.
Because that was the thing. It was always plugins didn't sound as good as analog gear, but
that's
changed. They could sound better, you know?
Yeah.
And also just not having to write down every setting on every piece of equipment on a piece of paper.
It's totally. Like,
people romanticize analog days, but one of my horrible tasks was getting in behind a big desk and rewiring an entire patch bay as a kid. And it was like a punishment.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
So it reminds me, you said something on Twitter, I think just the other day, that, I wrote it down here. Let's see. I'm going to. Oh, you said it. Your brain and a laptop is all you need to make music.
Yeah.
Right now.
Yeah.
So is that a good thing?
I think so.
Yeah.
Because we're in this strange time where a kid with, I mean, I didn't, like, it was really hard for me to get my hands on gear to start making music, you know?
Yeah.
And a kid now with a cracked, cheap version of whatever software and his laptop can make like a top 10 hit, mm-hmm. you know, and that kind of democratizes mm-hmm. things really fast. Because like when I started, it was like you needed $100,000 to make a studio.
Sure.
And produce an album from that and then press it on vinyl and get it out there.
Yeah.
But now it's like a kid with his headphones and laptop can put out a track on SoundCloud and become a star. Mm-hmm. That's really important to me. Mm.
Yeah. You know, I mean, sometimes I wonder if the... You know, I feel like in some ways we're better off when that process takes longer.
Yeah, for the art of it.
Yeah,
yeah.
That we have the opportunity to develop.
Totally, I get it, yeah. I feel though, we were talking earlier about how so many A&R people miss the ball,
sure.
or miss the entire wave.
Yeah.
And one of the things about the immediacy, of course, I don't think everyone should just make a track and throw it up on SoundCloud, because that floods
right.
your whole system with noise that you can't find the good stuff in. I think there should be a process. But another thing is, like, if you look at a kid can put up a track and say, like, let the fans decide,
mm-hmm.
and kind of almost crowdsource their own creativity and have real feedback in their comments about their track, like, that's something that no one ever had as a musician before, because
right.
the A&R guy can be completely clueless.
Sure.
You know, and miss the best track on that album.
Yeah.
Whereas the fans go, no. It's like, techno DJs always joke about that, like, your track is really a kind of strange dichotomy. Like, that, maybe the fifth or sixth track on that demo
mm-hmm.
will be what I would love to sign to my label. Mm-hmm. And artists send me all these demos and go, oh, but did you not like the first three? And I'm like, no, really, like, five and six, go play them in a club and you'll see what I mean.
That's funny.
If you're enjoying this one, let's go back in the Rebel Radio archives. Check out my interview with Will Clark, one of Sion's close collaborators. He was caught up with Will at Coachella in the interview tent, RV, whatever that was. We had a short episode together, but had a good time talking to Will and learning a little bit about what he was up to. So you can go check that one out after you're done here.
It's interesting. I just read an article today about you know, how artists are putting their first song, their best songs first,
yeah,
on the albums, and it was about the Spotify algorithm.
Yeah,
and so, you know, I think it's you know, it says something that you would get to somebody's fifth track,
yeah,
especially if you didn't love
yeah.
the first.
Yeah, yeah, and I mean, I think that's kind of the interesting thing I've learned about demos, is that sometimes what the artist is doing, they'll just put the track that they made yesterday first,
right?
Because that's what artists like.
That's what they're excited about.
Yeah, is what they did yesterday. What they did a week ago or even a month ago, they're like over it already.
Yeah.
But for a fresh listen, that's the important one, you know?
Yeah. So people are sending you demos.
Yeah,
all
a lot.
The time, I'm sure.
A lot.
And so how much of your signing is that? Like, how much are you pitching artists to sign to you
yeah.
versus them pitching you?
Nowadays, we have a really nice crew of people, like regular people that we work with, like a
yeah.
roster of artists.
Yeah.
But in the start, I was digging through every demo, and I still listen to pretty much everything.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
As much as it pains me sometimes, because there's a lot of irrelevant music. I wouldn't say good or bad. It's just
sure.
not relevant
not what
to
doing.
What we want to do. Yeah, because we're kind of niche.
Yeah.
But... yeah, I listen to a lot of new music.
Yeah.
And even sometimes I really like it, but it's just not for us, so I won't respond. You know?
So how do you pitch an artist? I don't know how much this actually happens.
Yeah.
Like, how do you pitch an artist
yeah.
to sign to your label or to give you a track, right? Because the
yeah.
people, you know, you're not signing exclusive deals, right?
To some, yeah.
Are you?
There's a couple of artists that are
okay.
exclusive to us.
But mostly they're track deals, right?
Yeah,
and
yeah.
And so... you have a relationship with them, but they also work with half a dozen other
yeah.
labels.
Yeah.
So how does that, like, give me a, what's the pitch?
Mostly the old fashioned way.
Yeah.
Send them some music from the label.
Cocaine,
start. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. It's mostly like getting to know the person as well. I think obviously most of these things happen in a backstage or get them onto their promo list, feed them with loads of music from the label. If they're coming back with loads of positive feedback, then it's a very easy ask to say, why don't you do something for the label next?
Sure.
It's one of my traits.
No, it's smart.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's kind of natural because if you're feeding someone music and they're really responsive, it doesn't matter what size they are, is it what size profile, if they want to do it, it's up to them. You know, we've had some really big artists do stuff on the label and they were like, I just like what you do. Like, don't worry about it. We'll do this as a swap or, you know, we'll figure out some paperwork later, but let's just get it out, you know.
Nice. And do you have like a wish list of artists that you...
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think now in this strange period where we're transitioning into being like a broader spectrum label, there's a lot of people that I'd love to work. I mean, I would love to bring all kinds of artists onto the label and develop them as making like albums rather than just singles all the time, which, I mean, I know it's kind of a singles market, but that's honestly... bores me sometimes because I really want to hear an artist like make a trip, you know.
Well, it's a singles market. I mean, it is, but you know, I think especially so if you're making music for Spotify, for SoundCloud.
Yeah, right? yeah.
I think those specifically are really singles formats.
But
you know, the music industry can't just be about that.
I know.
And I think that's hard for a lot of labels. And actually, the underground labels, I think, have a better opportunity because the streaming dollars are limited anyway.
Yeah, yeah, totally.
Right? Not that they're not important.
The getting more important.
Streaming is important, for sure. Yeah. But, you know, but you're never going to get, you know, Pitbull streaming numbers.
Or
whatever his name is. Yeah. Luis Fonsi, right? Like, that's not happening.
Yeah.
So you've got to have different revenue streams. And, you know.
It's really interesting. We had a meeting with our aggregator, and they, what they're being told by a lot of the streaming companies is like, hoover up that underground label structure and really make it interesting in terms of passing that on to a wider audience. So like recently tracks of mine have popped up in these big Spotify playlists that I'm super happy about because they're not necessarily something, I mean it's happening naturally because I'm making music that's broader and working with different people. And it's really interesting how that changes your profile with the normal festival goer versus the anorak train spotter techno fan, you know.
So who's, when you talk about this vision for the label that's more broad than what you've been doing, who's done that?
I don't think many people have, apart from, I would say, labels, you mean people that have taken a label to a point where it's bringing in other genres, and I'd say maybe Owlsla, Boys Noise. To a certain extent Gisafel Style. I would say like Ed Banger and XL. I mean XL was like a straight underground label back in the 90s The Prodigy happened and Zombie and the XX and you know they're an actual record company.
What about, I know we were talking about festivals and Miami, what's it called now? Miami Music Week?
Yeah.
I still call it Miami Music Conference.
Yeah, yeah.
It's coming up. Yeah. Does that still matter?
Yeah, definitely. It's obviously a lot more focused on EDM because of Ultra, but for example, I still do a party there every year. Mm-hmm. We were doing the Wynwood Factory this year.
Nice. And what do you get out of that? Like,
I think it's just being present and trying to establish a brand in techno at I mean, we're opening up a lot more. Like this year, we've got Will and mm-hmm. Sasha Abadi and Mele playing with us. And, you know, before we brought in like Ellen Allian or DJs that are a little bit more indie or crossover too.
I still
think it's relevant, and I'd like to be there, you know, even if it's just for one night. Like,
sure. No, I mean, I try to go when I can.
Yeah.
You know, I don't go every year, but I go off and on just to see people and whatever.
Yeah.
But I always think, like, it's interesting how you know, there's so many festivals, conferences, you know, Southwest happening now.
Like, yeah.
It's... sometimes you just feel like you have to be in everything and not necessarily understand what you're getting out of it.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. You pick your battles.
Yeah.
Mm. I get to this point where I'm like, you know, really choosing what I should be out on the road for.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. It can affect your whole...
Of course. Your whole existence. It's time away from the studio and away from...
Yeah, and also house. Just... you become really disillusioned sometimes with what it is, you know, like you land in a city, some person in a nice car picks you up, you go to the venue, hopefully you're paid well, and blah, 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 you stay in a nice hotel, and you're just kind of the only person that's on their own for the whole period. Right. It's strange. You never think about that. Because bands go on tour and they have their bandmates with them. Not sure. That, I mean, I like
to spend... sometimes good and sometimes not, right?
Exactly. But, I mean... a lot of DJs, I like to be on my own for vast amounts of time, reading or working or whatever. But of course, you know, I miss girlfriend and home and everything. Mm-hmm. But a lot of DJs go absolutely nuts with that. And that's where I think a lot of the problems with their lifestyle come from, like substance abuse,
sure.
Mental health issues. Yeah. Because if you think about it, it's a really weird life. Like, you're on your own on holiday all the time.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
It's really weird.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
And you're sort of like alone with a lot of people.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
Which is a weird experience,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, totally. And that's, I think that's one thing that can make people feel the most isolated is not just being on their own, but being around people that make them feel like they're really alone, you know? Because if you look at it, the average DJ falls into that pitfall really quick of just going to the after party with strangers.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's like more about lifestyle choices.
Sure. Yeah. Of course.
Mm.
Who's a big techno fan that surprised you?
Georgia Moroder.
Oh yeah?
Yeah. Maybe who else? Grace Jones.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
I can see her being in techno.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. There's a few. I mean, Madonna's an obvious one. She worked with tons of good people. Yeah. It's interesting. I mean, I would be surprised to see how many people in fashion, especially nowadays, like people like Rick Owens and Raf Simons is a huge techno fan. And it's like kind of makes sense
because
they come from those backgrounds. But yeah.
I think if they're German, it doesn't count.
Yeah, I've had people like Puffy and stuff show up too.
Sure.
When I was, you know, playing at clubs like Space or whatever.
Yeah.
And you were kind of like, they get it, you know.
Yeah. Well, he's obviously a huge dance music fan.
Yeah.
Kind of, you know, immersed himself in that some years ago.
Yeah.
In the house. Well, I was thinking about, I just, you know, we were talking about sort of the subgenres and that, and so I know, you know, you're with, you know, you have the same manager as Deadmau5.
Yeah.
Right, or same company.
Yeah.
So clearly, you know, clearly they get the different, they get it, right?
Yeah.
How much of that, I don't know, how much of that do you run into of like,
a crossover like that.
Yeah, yeah, or just the lines between these genres.
It is quite rare that someone at their level of success in a more, I mean, Deadmau5 is, I wouldn't consider it commercial music. He still has that punk attitude where he will put out music that he just likes,
sure,
you know, regardless of whether that, you know, people think it should be successful or not, but
right,
he has a knack of doing that. And
yeah, and his music was never the, like, yeah, you know, Alesso.
Yeah, no.
Like the really big room,
yeah, kind of stuff. It always had an angle to it, like an under, a kind of feeling of like experimentation in a way. You know? It was like weird, big music, which I really like.
Sure.
Yeah, it's rare for them to get the kind of underground stuff, and I think, not that I'm a super underground guy or anything, but I feel like that's a really interesting place for me to be, is to come from that background and to progress into making music for like a bigger stage.
Yeah.
That's kind of what happened naturally with me.
Yeah.
Like the music that I'm going to be putting out in the next year is a strange mixture of acid and electro stuff and sounds from drum and bass and sounds from death metal and weird creepy 80s vocals and guitars and
so that's exciting.
Yeah And
is there fear with that?
Oh yeah, of course, but I feel like I can't stop doing that because I started on a path of, you know, I got quite limited feeling like I can just make 4/4 hard, sure, techno records.
Yeah.
And from that feeling of like being feeling really trapped and like a ceiling over your head, I started messing around again with my guitar and with all these effects and all this stuff, and I think what came out of that was just all my influences together. I'm much happier making music like that now. I couldn't continue just doing straight underground techno records.
Yeah,
it's not part of my evolution, you know.
Nice.
Mm.
Okay, lightning round.
Yeah, go for it.
What's your favorite city to travel to?
At the moment, I'd have to say Tokyo.
Oh, I love Tokyo.
Mm.
I saw Massive Attack there.
Oh, yeah.
Year and a half ago.
Nice.
Amazing.
Yeah.
And it's cool to see them in that.
Totally, yeah. Yeah, that's a good one. Mm. Where were they playing?
It was some warehouse down.
Yeah.
Yeah. But towards the airport.
Okay, yeah. Naruga.
I don't know. Mm. It was really cool.
Very cool, yeah.
Who's your favorite DJ?
I would say maybe someone like Ivan Smag, who's mixing up rock, psychobilly, techno, like anything, and can somehow make it all sound like a party, you know?
That's cool. What's the last great book you read?
I would say, just recently I finished Zoo City by Lauren Bucus.
Okay.
Yeah. Which is really good and super weird.
I don't know.
And also Lunar Park by Bret Easton Ellis.
Okay.
Mm.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I haven't read either of those.
Yeah. I'm a big audiobook freak. So.
Me too.
Yeah.
And actually, there's an Irish author that I read a lot.
Flannery O'Connor?
Tanakh French.
Okay. Yeah. Interesting.
I love her stuff.
Yeah.
Like it's like cop, like mystery.
Yeah. Cool. I should give you some audiobooks.
Oh yeah.
A bunch of new stuff. Yeah.
Nice. Right on. What movie have you seen the most in your life?
Blade Runner. Yeah. The final cut probably. That and Dune were like huge influences on me.
Yeah.
Maybe. Yeah. Yeah, if someone's put me on the spot, definitely Blade Runner. It's a classic.
Sure.
Classic techno DJ
thing. Absolutely. You know? Yeah. I think you might be our second guest who's
Blade Runner. Yeah.
I mean, it's a great movie, but it's like it's an intense movie. You can't just like throw it on.
Yeah.
And
fold
laundry or whatever.
Yeah.
Tell me one decision that changed your life forever.
Getting my face tattooed.
What are some unexpected consequences?
You know what's really weird is the demographic of people that will come up to me and say like, you're a very nice young man, but why did you tattoo your face and your hands and your neck?
Yeah.
But more so, it's like a kind of 6-year-old retired, like, older lady who will always come and go, I love your tattoos, they're so artistic.
Really?
Yeah, it's super weird.
That's crazy.
That and teenagers. Uh-huh. They just think they're badass, you know?
Yeah, I'm sure. That's so funny. Complete this sentence for yourself. I don't have talent, I have blank.
I would say ambition.
It's good.
Or drive, better.
So if I worked for you, what's something I would hear you say over and over?
Can you swear?
Yeah.
No, I'm usually pretty mind blown by almost everything that happens in the day. Because it's always different. You know, I'm always finding myself going, I don't fucking believe this, you know? Like, dealing with artists, dealing with people in the industry, just dealing with things that are, like, kind of inexplicable in a good way, too. You know, I'm always super surprised by everything that's going on.
Yeah.
Doing this stuff and running the app and whatever.
I mean, that's probably great to not lose that. You know, I think when it becomes routine, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, you lose the magic.
Yeah. For better or for worse, I could say I'm constantly surprised by stuff, which is like, I have a naive, childish thing like that, you know?
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah. I want to keep that.
Nice.
Somehow.
Who would you be most excited to learn appreciates your work?
That's a good one. I would say probably not anyone in music, unless it was someone like Hans Zimmer or something like that. Mm-hmm. I would say probably more so someone from film, because I watched so many movies and I'm so, like, grew up just glued to sci-fi.
Yeah.
I would say, maybe a director, you know, someone like Christopher Nolan, or maybe Darren Aronofsky, something like that.
Nice. Yeah. I could see Darren being into it.
Yeah, that'd be amazing. Yeah.
I don't know him, but his partner, I went to high school with his,
his
production partner.
Cool.
Yeah, he's an old friend. Funny.
I'm a huge fan.
Yeah.
Huge fan.
Yeah, I mean, his stuff is.
Yeah, really, really unique. Or, even like, I suppose, someone from the film industry, because that would be somewhere I'd like to go in the future to make music for film.
That's cool. Cool, man, thank you for doing this.
Absolutely, my pleasure.
Fun talking to you. We'll be watching for all the next moves. What's coming up next?
I'll be in a bunch of other cities April through August. I'm trying to get an album together. I'm not sure where it'll come out, but I'm going to wrap it up, complete some visual stuff that accompanies it, and then go out and tour it as a live show.
Nice.
See how that goes.
Yeah. Awesome. And so where does everybody find you online?
DJCM.com or 720 group or 720.com or Octopus Recordings. It's my label.
Cool.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Hey, that was Sion on Rebel Radio. I hope you enjoyed it. I know I did. Let us know what you think. Give us a review, ratings, 5 stars, blah, blah, blah. iTunes. Hit us with a comment on Twitter, on Facebook, at Rebel Radio Net. You can see videos from a lot of our episodes on our YouTube page. And most importantly, come back next week for more Rebel Radio. Peace.